Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
And welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry, and I'm joined, as always, by Graham.
Hello.
And by Derek.
Hello.
Marvellous. Well, chaps, I'll spare the usual refrain and say it seems like ages since we were last together, because it's getting a bit tedious now, because that's just because it has been ages since we were last together. We keep talking about doing more of these things because we've got so much time on our hands because of the lockdown. But in fact, we usually end up weeks going by before we do another episode of Whom Pods Destroy. But it is very agreeable to see your faces, both of you, or faces, I should say. We're here to discuss another episode of the original series of Star Trek, which is The Squire of Gothos. Oh, it's been a while since we've done like an original series. When was the last original series of Star Trek we did? Given that we're a TOS podcast, when was the last episode we actually did?
But did we do Space Seed? Was that the one?
Yes, which was obviously, yeah, that's right. It must have been Space Seed. So that was the one before last. Because the last one was Discovery, then it was Wrath of Khan,
yes,
and then it was Space Seed. And then we went through the whole thing of doing a motion picture season, a sort of build up to motion picture, in which we did some TOS episodes. But we also did some movies, including 2001. All of this was before the lockdown when, you know, things were wild and crazy and everything seemed possible. And that included a TOS podcast not doing TOS episodes. But this is the uber austere 2021. And we're now back where we should be, and that is doing original series episodes. And we're doing The Squire of Gothos. It's a first season episode, and an episode, it has to be said, with a considerable legacy. Not least of which because of the character Trelane. Graham, tell us a little bit about the legacy of Trelane, because, I mean, it should be obvious, or articulate, if you will, the legacy of Trelane for the benefit of ourselves and our listeners.
Well, apart from being one of the best guest stars of the original series, I would say that the leftovers of the character was to provide inspiration for further characters in the Next Generation to provide Q. That's what immediately springs to mind in a lot of fans. But I think that does kind of lessen what the episode actually is. The episode starts the germ of the idea of the episode is meant to be anti-war. And you end up with this character who is a very powerful, childlike character. It's very much a trope from the 50s and 60s television, a lot of Twilight Zone stuff. This could easily be a Twilight Zone episode in many ways. But you end up with this character, Trelane, a very, very powerful but innocent innocent is the right word, or childlike innocence in his actions, but also has very, very much the spitefulness of a child as well. He's a character I think you can see not just in Q, but in a lot of Star Trek characters that have gone on in the rest of the original series and throughout the franchise up to today. And of course, played wonderfully by Bill Campbell, William Campbell. And I think he is someone who guest actors have looked on and used as a benchmark in their roles. And you can certainly see that even recurring characters in series like Deep Space Nine. I think in someone like Garak, you can almost see that role as someone you're allowed to be a bit more over the top, a bit more stage. And I think that's what the wonderful thing about this episode is its lovely stage work.
Yes, indeed, Derek, the stage work on this is beautiful to see. The thing that strikes me about it is there was an opportunity to broaden the scope of this episode a little bit more. When the landing party first arrive and they're approaching the castle, before we see the castle, there's a moment of pause and then they present us with the doorway, the gateway to the castle. But we don't obviously see the whole castle. We only see that section of it. as though it were, to me, a set. If you were sitting in a theatre, that's how you would see a castle portrayed, wouldn't you? And they missed the opportunity, or did they, to drop in an Albert Whitlock matte painting from the cage, of the castle from the cage, to maybe give the episode some scale and some grandeur, and to say, look, it's a big castle, it's really there. But they didn't do that. It might well be that they just simply forgot that they had this matte painting. But I would like to think, actually, that there was a deliberate creative decision to say, no, we're going to make this feel a lot more theatrical in appearance, more like a stage play. And so we're not going to have that. We're going to reduce the confines, the scope of this episode visually. What do you think of that opinion?
The whole thing is very theatrical, but I didn't have a problem with them going to the castle and not seeing everything, because for me it had already been put forward that the whole planet is habitable, and this seemed to me to be like a pocket area. You know, this is the magical little spot, so you didn't see everything else out there because it was a wilderness, you know, of gases and stuff like this. And I just thought, if anything, the castle keep doors act as the, you know, the entrance to a stage, like a stage entrance, pulled into it, and then you go into the next part of the act, and you can, you know, and then they start basically doing all the acting chops, you know. And it was a very much a theatrical thing. The other thing that I found straight away, it felt like I was just referencing the old Batman TV series, because you, with Batman, you had guest stars who were given the chance to basically just overact. And, you know, and it felt like that as well. Also, it felt like there was Liberace was there, because the first time you see Trelane, he's playing his harpsichord, and he does a great Liberace impression, you know, with even looking back at the camera over his shoulder. You know, it's really up there, like really camping it up. You know, but it brings you in because there's a lot of joy in it. There is a lot of joy in there, but also that, you know, you are there with the team that's actually beamed down there. You know, you're with the away team. And you're finding this new adventure here, you know, with this, you know, what the hell is happening here? But you really get into it. But the Trelane character brings an immediate joy into it, even though it obviously is a dangerous situation.
Graham, did you find it joyful, the introduction of Trelane, or did you? Because my reaction, and this is probably, again, I mean, I'm doing my best to pretend that I've seen this for the first time, when in fact it's about the 50th time that I've seen it. But my overriding feeling about that is the deliberate jarring of what is essentially a kind of very sincere, authentic Gothic horror experience. The imposing castle doors, salt vampires aren't usually associated with the Gothic horror experience, but the sort of like macabre decor on the walls, the two figures, Kirk and Sulu, frozen in aspect, all very sinister, and with really powerful Gothic horror images. But then you get that kind of almost like a kind of Phantom of the Opera kind of thing hit you with Trelane. But well, now, of course, I can't get Liberace out of my head. But do you think that worked?
Certainly, but I think going against what you said to start off this, when you said about the matte painting and seeing the outside of the castle, I think giving it that whole stage feel, like you were watching a stage performance, adds to the whole fakeness of Trelane's setup, and I like that. I do perhaps wish it had been in a bigger room. In a larger area, but obviously they've got the constrictions of studio size there. But my God, they do fill up that set, don't they? It's got they have raided the Paramount prop department, haven't they? And they just chucked everything they possibly can in there, and to great effect. Obviously, this is an episode they could have made dirt cheap. absolute dirt cheap in the middle of season one. So it, for them to come out with such a good episode out of this for basically nothing, the price of a guest star really, is brilliant. And I think that the whole feel, the whole gothic feel, is just right, because it hasn't got to be authentic as far as the story is concerned. The whole thing about it is that it's all style and no substance, and that's what really comes across, and you're always being fed that all the way through it, the fire without any heat, the brandy with no taste, and everything about it has that feeling. It's almost they're almost parodying themselves by saying that, well, we present this sort of stuff to you every week, and it's not real. It's just fake. Look, it's polystyrene. It's, look, if these walls shake if you touch them. So there is that almost little feeling that they're almost playing with you a bit. They're almost sort of bringing you in on the act.
Yeah, you wouldn't have been surprised if at the end of the episode it just would have ended with just sort of like William Shatner just doing a big clap to snap the audience out of the illusion and bring everybody back to reality. Let's just celebrate a little bit further Bill Campbell's performance, because there's so much that makes this episode. But his performance is among the finest guest star performances of any Star Trek episode, and certainly of the original series. It is a virtuoso performance, and it's one of those episodes in which the guest star really is the actual star. You can certainly tell on rewatching the bits of the dialogue and the bits of the acting where he is behaving like a child, although the audience is some way behind yet, and we're not quite figuring that out. But the tells are definitely in there. A discerning audience member may be watching this and thinking, well, there is something about this character that isn't quite right. But also the fact that he's able to switch, Derek, from being jolly and fun and full of sallies of wit, you know, and then to suddenly becoming very sinister, just like the change of pitch, the change of tone, change of expression. Absolutely, you know, it's a shame that it's just an episode of a TV series, because it was a virtuoso performance. I think, you know, I mean, any actor should look back on that and would think that if it had been them, they would be consider it to be one of the great roles of their career, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I mean, it was pure vaudeville as well. And the other thing that, as Graham was going on about, it reminded me, it's also Roger Corman is what this is. You know, the whole thing, the set, you know, the sets, and then just letting the actors go loose like a Vincent Price, you know, and the audience just lapping it up. I really thoroughly enjoyed this. And I'm glad that William Campbell, he obviously was throwing everything into it. Was this the first time he appeared on Star Trek?
Yes, certainly, yes. He Trouble with Tribbles is in as Koloff in the second season. And then, of course, I'm sure DS9 fans will be aware of his revisitation of Koloff in Blood Oath. Well, I think he might just do the voiceover for Koloff in the animated series.
I think he does, actually, yes.
Yeah, I think he did. We would look it up, but we're just not that kind of podcast.
No, we're not that good.
That's becoming a nice catchphrase now, Terry. Stick with it.
Because we're here for the opinions, not the facts. Not here for the facts. Although what is a fact is I was listening to George Takei's remembrances on one of the old VHS introductions on YouTube just before this. When Campbell read for the role, he read one paragraph of one of Trelane's monologues and was cast immediately, and they went straight to wardrobe. It's just one of those serendipitous moments when a character and an actor are brought together, and it's perfect and absolutely magical.
Yeah, apparently it was originally written for Roddy McDowall, Which would have made it a very interesting role. You could easily imagine him being Trelane, and giving that sort of childlike quality to it. But it would have been very different, not worse or better, but I just think a completely different feel to it.
No, I think you're right. I think it would have been equally as good. I think that would have been excellent if Roddy McDowall had been Trelane. But in a totally excellent, totally different, excellent way.
Yeah.
To William Cowper, because Roddy McDowall is peerless, and it's something of a tragedy that he never found his way onto Star Trek in some way, shape, or form throughout his lengthy career.
I'd say that having William Campbell in here, he definitely is more of a template for Q later on in The Next Generation than if Roddy McDowall did it, I would say, because he's got that overtly sort of like playboy, you know, sort of like thespian sort of part to it. Roddy McDowall has a lot of facets to him, but I think that he would have played it more of a tragic. I've always seen, you know, Roddy McDowell's been a bit more tragic in his characters that he's played.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great actor, but he always has that sort of a couple more sides. But this is like, you know, this is much more flamboyant.
Tends to play a bit of a schmuck sometimes, doesn't he, Robert?
Yeah.
Roddy McDowell.
Yeah.
I know he's famous for Planet of the Apes, but he tends to be cast as a bit of a schmuck.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether or not it would have necessarily have done that.
Bill Campbell was very, very good friends with Gene Coon. They were best buddies. So I wonder if that friendship allowed him a greater understanding than other just overacting guest stars in, whether or not that gave him an inside view of the series. Because I think as well, one of the most memorable things about his role is the way he interacts with pretty much everybody he comes in contact with, which is unlike guest stars. Guest stars usually only interact with the main three characters, but for him to interact with even the red shirts that are there to give them some kind of billing, is great. I think that's goes some of the way to making this role a lot more memorable, especially for diehard Trek fans, because who likes to try to remember all the names of the extra guest crew that only turn up for one episode.
With the introductions and the interactions with Dasal and Sulu and Officer Yeager, which were largely wonderful, extremely, extremely entertaining, and just obviously just reflecting the kind of character that Trelane had adopted, and the Honourable Sir reference, and I enjoyed Sulu's reaction. Obviously, a lot of it is the relationship that he has and the interaction that they have between Trelane and Kirk, Campbell and Shatner. But I do think that it is worth the just reflecting on the few moments that we enjoyed between Trelane and Spock, particularly I don't think I like your tone kind of thing. And you do have one saving grace: you're ill-mannered. Yeah. And some but there's even while Trelane is wooing the two women, Yeoman Ross and Lieutenant Uhura, there's a beautiful cutaway. Spock's just like rolling his eyes and taking deep breaths and saying, "This bloke's a twat." It's like the reaction, and I think that this is where I think we should just celebrate Don McDougall, who is the director of this show. It's a really well shot and really some really good, clever editing choices to be made there in terms of the character byplay that works extremely well. And I particularly enjoyed his attempt to woo and seduce the two women immensely. Those opening sequences, or that initial sequence in his study, in his dining room, I just set the scene superbly. But perhaps we just reflect a bit on the progress of the story actually through this, because the thing that strikes me about the cleverness of the environment with which they've got there is that you're talking about a super powerful being who can do anything, you know, anything within, almost anything that he wants. And in order to be able to get away with authentically portraying that on a very, very low budget TV show, I wonder if what the added genius of the reason why they did it on a soundstage was to limit the scope of the story to make it much, much easier to convey the level of power.
If you look at the first season's concern, the episode with the most parallels with this one is Charlie X, where you've got a very powerful being who's also behaves like a child, but it's handled completely differently. And again, there because of the purpose of story, but also because it makes quite a good story, he attaches himself to Kirk as well in a certain respect, or tries to play off him, or there is some connection there. And in the same way, look, Charlie X is a bottle episode, but it does get that the confinement of that makes his power greater, doesn't it? It makes it more pressing and urgent, because there's nowhere to escape. There's no big fields to run into. He's got you in his lair, and this time it is his lair. It's not just the starship that some kid with superpowers is controlling it. So yeah, you're right. The confinement, this is something we often go back to, isn't it? It's when Star Trek's at its best, when it's working with its limitations, not fighting them. And in this episode, it is working with its limitations perfectly, and hence it works so well.
But when it needs to broaden the scope of the story, when they escape for the second time. And I do love the back and forth, you know, on the bridge, off the bridge, sort of like feel to this episode. But of course, we're then in a very, very effective way and a very, very cheap way able to discover just how powerful Trelane is, because he can literally move worlds.
You mentioned Charlie X, but this one, he is a godlike character in this, you know, godlike power, alien entity. And usually, in a lot of episodes, we've seen situations where they can actually defeat it. Because the Trelane isn't defeated in this at all. There's no defeat at all, except for right at the end, you know, when he gets his scolding. But, you know, if he wanted to continue on, he would have destroyed everyone. You know, there was no way the Enterprise could have actually defeated them, except Kirk or Spock trying to outwit him. But they didn't in this episode. There's no outwitting at all in this episode, even though Kirk did stand up for himself in the trial part, which is reflected later on in the Next Generation episode, Encounter of Farpoint. You know, which is, you can see that's been taken from there. And of course, Encounter of Farpoint also takes the situation when the Enterprise is being chased. You know, this time you're being chased by a planet which is going all over the place and stopping the Enterprise escape. While in a counter far point, Q is chasing the Enterprise with his sphere type thing. I can't remember what it was. It was quite a while back ago since I've seen it. The point I'm trying to make is that, you know, this is one of the templates to the godlike characters in the Star Trek universe. You know, it really lays down the foundations for the Star Trek verse that has continued on through all of the series that we've had afterwards. And it's a smasher of an episode for that, because it doesn't really step out of place too many, you know, at all, really, I think, actually.
It's a much better episode than Encounter of Farpoint. Given the technical and financial constraints, it's a technically superior episode. Because it makes much, much better use of the resources that it has available to have a very evenly toned story that runs through it. Because Graham, you know, we go from, you know, moving planets around to the next scene in which we're in this incredibly confined, very small courtroom, which beautifully lit, it has to be said, by the director of photography, Jerry Finneman, just between these two protagonists, and this is where the climax of the episode comes about. And it's extremely artful that they're able to juggle these concepts the way that they do and make it absolutely work and make complete sense.
Oh, perfectly. And the use of the shadow of the noose rather than the noose itself.
Yes.
Perfect.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly perfect. Exactly what you'd expect to see if you were to see a stage play. Any stage director worth his salt would have done it exactly the same way. And really does pivot the whole episode around there, where you've got where the first half is on this set that's just got so much stuff crammed in it. And then you've got this scene where it's just pared down to the bare minimum. It reminds me a lot of the stuff you'd go on to see in season 3, in that respect, where they were really paring down sets. But to see this in the first series, when it's done really well.
And it's no accident. Spectre of the Gun, I think, is a brilliant example of what you do when you've got absolutely no money left and you're trying to put together some kind of set, put together a Western set. And it's perfect. But it is kind of by accident. Just moving on to the actual denouement then, the final, I think the final chase sequence at the end is fairly limited in fairness, and probably ticks the box to say, well, you have to have a bit of action and a bit of fighting in it.
Yeah.
But I think that it's just dawning on Kirk, I think, just at the point where he's being, held, where Trelane is about to run him through, about to kill him after the chase. And it's just dawning on Kirk at that point and thinking, this is some kind of child, isn't he? And he's just beginning perhaps to, do you think, just beginning to realize? Usually in a situation like this, Kirk finds a way of talking himself out of this situation, usually by, obviously, if it's a superior computer, it's by reasoning it to death to destroy itself, or he's usually got a good way of talking. But he really had run out of answers, and I think it was only beginning to dawn on him, Derek, just at that point that he was about to die, I thought, I'm about to get killed by some snotty-nosed kid. But then, thankfully, his parents intervene.
Yeah, I also think that is probably... Kirk, this is one of those episodes where Kirk is being the martyr, the sacrificing himself completely for the ship, and it probably does occur to him in the end, it's a bit pointless. Because this person there can do what the hell it wants afterwards, and Kirk is totally defeated. But you are right, it probably does dawn on, but it also dawns on the audience, I suppose, in that the whole thing is it's an entertainment to the character Trelane anyway, because it's all a bit, he's just doing everything for his own enjoyment. He's a narcissist. It's just, he is like a kid. He's playing with a couple of ladybirds, squashing a couple as he goes along, but there is an outcome that could end up with complete obliteration. So it was nicely tied up at the end, and it gave the complete release to the audience when we finally see these two green globs hanging in the air, with these lovely voices going,
One of which is the lady from who turns up in an episode. Is it the...
Two episodes.
Two episodes.
She turns up in Plato's Stepchildren and A Taste of Armageddon.
That's it. And A Taste of Armageddon, that's the one I was
she
trying to think of.
She does a few other voiceovers as well in there. I think she's one of the voices in Tholian Web, I think, and another episode as well. Operation Annihilate, I think, as well.
And do we know who did the voiceover for Trelane's father?
Well, I thought for years that it was Jimmy Doohan.
So did I.
Yeah, and I thought...
But it's not.
And I think I know why we both think that is because Alan Asherman said so in the Star Trek companion that we both had.
Yes, that's it. I'm sure I read it from somewhere, and I thought I guess it was in Asherman, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But Asherman was wrong.
I think it was a guy called Bert LaRue, who was also the voice of the Guardian Forever.
Guardian of Forever. Because that's right, because I had also heard that the voice of the Guardian of Forever was also Jimmy Doohan.
No, but it's not.
But no, it's not. Jimmy Doohan played every single non-player character in the animated series and was a noted voiceover artist, but he didn't in those. Yeah. Ah, okay.
Major Barrett obviously did a lot of voices in the animated series and did a lot of the voiceovers in the original series.
So let's just quickly talk about the guest star. There is a notable guest star in this, in the rather lovely shape of Anita Wolf, who was not an actress for a very long time, it should be said, but it's a memorable role because she looks wonderful in that dress. But it's clearly she's supposed to be Yeoman Rand at this point, isn't she? I don't know whether or not in the early drafts it was Yeoman Rand, but there was still this need to have the Yeoman.
It was the same relationship to Yeoman Rand, you know, which was just a bit of, you know, fluff on the side and a bit of casual sexism, basically. Mm. You know, it didn't really see. She was lovely, and she actually did the speaking role parts that she had was great, but they just. It's, you know, there wasn't really much there, was there?
I mean, I thought that it was. I didn't get much chemistry between her and Kirk. I think it would have been so much better if that role had been played by Grace Lee Whitney, if Janice Rand had been in that, because then they were clearly working on some kind of will they won't they relationship. And it was slightly out of place. I mean, it was no big deal. Because sadly, as is often the way with 60s TV shows, as indeed is often the way with mainstream entertainment anyway, female characters tend to get the shit end of the deal. It's the blokes who tend to do most of it. Go on, Del.
I was just going to say, I mean, it typical of the Enterprise at that time. Who was that guy who was sitting in Kirk's seat in the captain's chair? Well, Uhura was over at the side. Surely she probably overran the bloke who was just sitting there. Okay, this bloke, he basically just sitting in the chair that I'm captain now. You know, it was a bit.
It was Mr. Kyle, wasn't it?
Was it Kyle? I think it might have been Kyle. Anyway, your point stands, Derek. Yeah, of course, it totally should have been to Uhura. She would have been the superior officer. But, you know, I mean, I think that that people considered that she was sort of like, she was the lady who answered the telephone in that show. And we didn't see her much. It was nice to see her getting away from that chair and out of the bridge and doing something moderately more interesting, even if that was actually being horribly manipulated by a horrible white man. But anyway, let us not dwell too much on that horrific symbolism. And Graham, you have something to say.
Well, it just reminds me a bit more about the links between this and Charlie X, because if Grace Lee Whitney had been in it, obviously we would have had another incident where this godlike entity attaches itself to her. In Charlie X, it's a bit more frightening, but and also as well, you've got Uhura playing some music as well. So the parallels between the two is it's starting to think this is just a rip off of Charlie X, isn't it? Well, bloody hell, I hate this episode now.
It's a rip-off of Charlie X and Encounter at Far. Oh, no, an Encounter at Far. So ultimately, it all goes back to Charlie X, isn't it? Let's just quickly dwell on, again, a little bit more on Far Point. And I like that courtroom scene. And I will confess to the listeners that I had forgot to piece it together, the courtroom scene in Squire of Gothos and the courtroom scene in Far Point, until Derek pointed it out just before we were recording. And it was as though the scales had fallen from my eyes. But yes, of course, there are direct parallels between Trelane and Q in that kind of that courtroom scene. And Derek, to what extent do you genuinely think that they looked at Trelane when they were devising the character of Q and said this is the guy that we're going to take this character and we're going to adapt him? And do you think that maybe? I mean, we could probably look this up, but what's your opinion? Do you think that the courtroom scene in Far Point is some kind of homage to the Squire of Gothos and to Trelane?
Well, actually, I think it's the actual Squire of Gothos theme is taken into Encounter of Far Point, because there's a theme that they could have developed more in Squire of Gothos, which is the idea that humanity is a war in race, which we had, you know, that was the thing that Trelane is enamored by, you know, and there was a bit of that where Kirk is trying to stand up and saying, we're not like that anymore, you know. And obviously later on in the encounter of Farpoint, the whole sequence of the courts is to do with Q putting humanity on trial for its warlike, you know, passions and stuff. So I think that they've used this episode to expand upon an interesting theme in science fiction about how good is humanity, you know, and that's what they've done. And obviously they've taken the character Trelane and expanded upon him. And as you can see, like later on when, you know, Trelane's been retrofitted into the Q continuum, you know, in various different forms.
Yeah, inside canon.
Inside
canon, not in actual canon. Yeah.
No, he's not
canonically, he's not Q.
No.
I mean, Peter David wrote a whole book about him being a Q, and Peter David is one of the more celebrated writers. He's a fantastic writer and an excellent Star Trek novelist, but, you know, it's still side canon.
They could easily have made him an Organian or something else, couldn't
totally.
They?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, or yeah, absolutely, or a Thracian or something like that from Charlie X. Again, Charlie X. Can we reflect on the messages of the film? Can we reflect on the messages of the episode, please? Because normally, in Star Trek of this vintage, or in fact of any vintage, likes to bang on the head its message, doesn't it? It likes to reinforce its message quite strongly. There is a clear anti-war message going on here, but it is also an episode that knows what it is. It knows it's a 50-minute piece of light entertainment. But I don't think that the film – what do I keep calling it a film? I don't think that the episode is lessened by the fact that they don't in any way attempt to articulate that message. I mean, it's what it tells you. I mean, when I was a kid, and you guys are roughly my age, you know, we used to play war back in the 1970s. We used to, me and our mates would go out, boys, and we'd go out and we'd pretend to shoot each other. You know, I used to go around the estate. And I don't know whether or not it was the same with you guys, but I suspect it probably was. It's a thing that boys did, and ultimately they still do now. Or they do it, instead they do it on the fields of Fortnite rather than in their local estates, but it is something that they do, and it's saying something about that, but it isn't spelling it out to you, and it's not, and they're not directly articulating that. Do you think, Graham? Do you think that the episode is, and the story and the message is lessened by that approach, or strengthened perhaps?
Yeah, I think that the episode throughout looks at dated values. And I think especially in the interactions between the different races and ethnicities of the crew members, even then you can almost imagine a sort of eye roll at the mild xenophobia that he's displaying, or the generalizations he's throwing out there. And this is like the mid-60s. Which, of course, you know, Southern California, mid-60s, it's starting to get quite cool. But you don't normally get that in there. Normally, you know, Star Trek is, when it's trying to break down barriers, it's still got huge barriers there as far as we would view it today. I don't think that the episode tries to wash over its messages, but I do think that the strength of the end of the story sort of takes everything away from it. At the end of it, it's just a kid with too much power, and he's told off by his parents, which seems rather laughable, really, when the fact that this higher being still has a mother and father that are nurturing it for some reason. It is sort of you're saying that like gods operate on our level, so that's which is the sort of message that has gone through the whole of like pagan religions and things like that, that the gods, while they're all powerful, they still have the same problems as you do. They can still act out and they can still be ridiculously childish. And which is a good message in one way. Well, it's a message that you can make a TV show out of anyway. But I think that's the overriding thing that people take away, I think, from this episode. If you were to describe this episode to someone, or ask them to describe it, they would probably say, "Oh yeah, that's the one with the God kid in it," and which is it, and which is why it's played so well by Campbell, because you've got this sort of middle-aged guy playing a kid, which adds to the twist to it, if it is a twist. As you say, it's not really treated as a twist, is it? Because you are fed that information all the way through it. And yes, if it had been played by Roddy McDowall, it might have been different. You might have suspected it a lot more, a lot quicker.
Yeah, Derek, it's not a twist, is it? It's just a convenient means of ending the episode and getting things back to normal, isn't it?
Yeah, that's actually probably right, actually, back to normal.
Almost like the big clap at the end, saying, right, snap out of it, kind of thing.
But it was an excellent episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
You know, you guys have always mentioned how Star Trek, the original series, is its best when it's an anthology series, when it's actually doing really good one-off stories that you move away from, and next week you get something even better. But it was great. It's good. But you're right. It's gone back to square one. No one died in this episode. No red shirts. You know. It's a win-win.
Yeah, it could easily have never happened. Is the whole thing about it, and it's like our own little ghost story, and it's the absolute. You're right, Derek. It's Star Trek at its finest, in my opinion, is when they tell these kind of anthology type stories. Although I do enjoy the serialization of later series, I do very much enjoy it. But for me, you know, its biggest strength is when they can just sort of like press the reset button. Derek, this was your idea, I believe this was Derek's idea, but I believe the idea of doing this stemmed from the conversations that we were having in our previous episode about the conclusion of Star Trek Discovery and the child who screamed and it shattered the world, shattered the universe, and we were dealing with the idea of how inauthentic or how unrealistic that is in Star Trek. And yet it's not. It goes all the way back to this episode, and indeed it goes further to Charlie X, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, Charlie X seems to be pulled up quite a lot in this, but you're right. Yeah, you know, and also probably goes back to some really cracking sort of new wave science fiction as well, or golden age science fiction. You know, it's the idea about sort of godlike but childlike intellects, you know, is always been in science fiction. You know,
and emotions shaping events and shaping material, which I think is a very, very cool new wave style science fiction concept. Probably not even new wave. It's a very, very good and actually probably quite a hard science fiction concept, I would say. So this is a proper story, I would suggest. Proper story, proper episode of Star Trek. Definitely one of the greats, and not a hidden gem by any means, because it's widely celebrated as well and recognized as such. Okay. Why don't we knock it on the head then, chaps? I would say that at this point we were going to go down the road and go and watch some football, but those still a few weeks off that. Still a few weeks off that. So we'll have some beer instead and discuss, well, Star Trek perhaps, or maybe football. Perhaps there's a football on the television. Thank you very much indeed for listening to this episode of Whom Pods Destroy. If you enjoyed the episode and you're a regular listener, why don't you either subscribe via a podcatcher, or if you just don't take trains anymore and don't need a podcatcher anymore, then just make a note of our podcast and remember to check back every now and then. If you remember how to do it, please do leave a 5-star rating and a nice review on I don't know, what is it now? Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Amazon, yeah, because we're on Amazon now. You know, anywhere where they say, would you like to read a review, then do that, as long as it's a nice one. So thanks very much indeed. So until next time, I don't know what we're doing next time, chaps, but I think there was talk of doing court martial as well. So why don't we agree to that then?
Yeah.
We'll do court martial next, and we'll do that in a few weeks' time, he said. Until then, from myself, from Derek, and from Graham, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.